All about the hills, the host of Mordor raged. The captains of the West were foundering in a gathering sea. The sun gleamed red, and under the wings of the Nazgul, the shadows of death fell dark upon the earth. Aragorn stood beneath his banner, silent and stern, as one lost in thought of things long past or far away. But his eyes gleamed like stars that shine the brighter as the night deepens. Upon the hilltop stood Gandalf, and he was white and cold, and no shadow fell on him. The onslaught of Mordor broke like a wave on the beleaguered hills, voices roaring like a tide amid the wreck and crash of arms. So, the eagles do indeed come, as Gandalf seemed to have, he seems to be the first one to have spotted them amidst the battle. Mm-hmm. The eagles are about to start straight up fighting the Nazgul right away, but, you want to take it?
But the Nazgul turned and fled and vanished into Mordor's shadows, hearing a sudden terrible call out of the Dark Tower. And even at that moment, all the hosts of Mordor trembled. Doubt clutched their hearts, their laughter failed, their hands shook and their limbs were loosed. The power that drove them on and filled them with hate and fury was wavering. Its will was removed from them, and now in the eyes of their enemies they saw a deadly light and were afraid. Then all the captains of the West cried aloud, for their hearts were filled with a new hope in the midst of darkness. Out from the beleaguered hills, knights of Gondor, riders of Rohan, Dúnedain of the North, close serried companies drove against their wavering foes, piercing the press with the thrust of bitter spears. But Gandalf lifted up his arms and called once more in a clear voice, "Stand, men of the West, stand and wait. This is the hour of doom." And even as he spoke, the earth rocked beneath their feet. Then, rising swiftly up, far above the towers of the Black Gate, high above the mountains, a vast soaring darkness sprang into the sky, flickering with fire. The earth groaned and quaked. The towers of the Teeth swayed, tottered, and fell down. The mighty ramparts crumbled. The Black Gate was hurled in ruin, and from far away, now dim, now growing, now mounting to the clouds, there came a drumming rumble, a roar, a long echoing roll of ruinous noise. "The realm of Sauron has ended," said Gandalf. "The Ring-Bearer has fulfilled his quest." And as the captains gazed south to the land of Mordor, it seemed to them that black against the pall of cloud, there rose a huge shape of shadow, impenetrable, lightning-crowned, filling all the sky. Enormous it was reared above the world, and it stretched out towards them a vast, threatening hand, terrible but impotent. For even as it leaned over them, a great wind took it, and it was all blown away, and passed, and then a hush fell.
At this point, what's left of the Mordor forces starts aimlessly wandering, witlessly, and purposelessly fleeing or even committing suicide on the spot, basically. Because with the destruction of Barad-dûr, that's the Dark Tower, nothing any longer has any real control of their minds, because that did to a certain extent, based on what we read the last chapter. But the evil allied men that were with them, lots flee, some actually surrender, but some have that millennia-long hatred of Gondor, and they fight to the bitter end. Mm-hmm. So Aragorn takes full command of the battle, while Gandalf asks Gwaihir, the Windlord, so that's the leader of the Eagles, for a ride, and this will be the third time he gets a ride with Gwaihir. The first time was after he escaped to escape Isengard. The second was when he came back in Moria, because he was at the top of the mountain. Mm-hmm. And Gwaihir says, "I would bury you whither you will, even if you were made of stone." And so Gandalf asked him, "Can you bring your brother and another eagle as well?" Mm-hmm. Clifford, why three eagles?
Well, practical reasons. One carries Gandalf, and we can assume the other two are for picking up Frodo and Sam, one each. Although, reasonably, the eagles could... it sounds like they're big enough that one could carry Frodo and Sam, or some combination thereof, but the three seems to have some significance.
Well, some people suspect the third eagle was for Gollum.
Oh, interesting. I'm glad that you are here with me, said Frodo. Here at the end of all things, Sam.
Yes, I am with you, Master, said Sam, laying Frodo's wounded hand gently to his breast. And you're with me, and the journey's finished. But after coming all this way, I don't want to give up yet. It's not like me, somehow, if you understand.
Maybe not, Sam, said Frodo, but it's like things are in the world. Hopes fail, and end comes. We have only a little time to wait now. We are lost in ruin and downfall, and there is no escape.
Well, Master, we could at least go further from this dangerous place. Here, from this crack of doom, if that's its name. Now, couldn't we? Come, Mr. Frodo, let's go down the path at any rate.
Very well, Sam. If you wish to go, I'll come, said Frodo.
So, Frodo, remember, he's already got the satisfaction of having saved Middle-earth, right? The ring's destroyed, that was his mission complete. Good. And we talked about last time, there's some Yu catastrophes where the epic hero wins, but doesn't make it out alive. Obvious one is Beowulf. He defeats the dragon, but dragon takes him down too.
Right. It's like their victory is their ultimate sacrifice.
Right, right. So they walk down a bit, but the volcano is absolutely letting loose at this point. Convulsing, quaking, smoke, steam, their last strength ebbing. They had reached a low ashen hill piled at the mountain's foot, but from there was no more escape. So the slow rivers of fire are basically engulfing them, and it's even raining ash at this point, right? So you want to take They Stood?
They stood now, and Sam, still holding his master's hand, caressed it. He sighed.
What a tale we have been in, Mr. Frodo, haven't we? He said. I wish I could hear it told. Do you think they'll say, now comes the story of Nine-Fingered Frodo and the Ring of Doom? And then everyone will hush, like we did, when in Rivendell they told us the tale of Beren One-Handed and the Great Jewel. I wish I could hear it, and I wonder how it will go on after our part.
But even while he spoke so, to keep fear away until the very last, his eyes still stayed north into the eye of the wind to where the sky far off was clear, as the cold blast, rising to a gale, drove back darkness and the ruin of the clouds. And so it was that Gwaihir saw them with his keen, far-seeing eyes, as the wild wind he came, and daring the great peril of the skies he circled in the air. Two small dark figures, forlorn, hand in hand upon the little hill, while the world shook under them, and gasped, and rivers of fire drew near. And even as he espied them and came swooping down, he saw them fall, worn out or choked with fumes and heat, or stricken down by despair at last, hiding their own eyes from death. Side by side they lay, and down swept Gwaihir, and down came Landreval and Meneldor the Swift. And in a dream, not knowing what fate had befallen them, the wanderers were lifted up and borne far away out of the darkness and the fire.
Okay, I guess we could, all right, Clifford, we can do a quick intro.
Okay.
How you doing?
Fine.
How you doing?
If you insist. I'm doing well. I just wanted to give our audience a quick intro in case they didn't read the title of the episode they clicked on, what was going on.
Yeah, if anybody's wondering the context of that, there will be a blooper at the end of this. How ridiculous Clifford was, but...
Okay, my apologies.
Not just going with my master plan. So.
Long story short, this is book 6, chapter 4, The Field of Cormallen.
All right, let's keep going.
Okay.
When Sam awoke, he found that he was lying on some soft bed, but over him gently swayed wide beechen boughs, and through their young leaves sunlight glimmered, green and gold. All the air was full of a sweet mingled scent. So, Sam immediately recognizes the smell. He remembers Ithilien, right? So, we remember Frodo might not remember any feeling about it, but for Sam, Frodo didn't remember like any feelings about any of the journey outside of Mordor, right? But for Sam, it was like the only pronounced pleasant place he's been to since the Fellowship's been broken, which was a solid month and a lifetime in a way, right?
Right. And it kind of made Sam's got this like love of gardens, and Ithilien is described as kind of being this once beautiful garden.
No, you're jumping ahead, Clifford.
Okay.
I gotta
sorry.
Cut that. we'll get there again. Okay. All right, but Sam goes on. He says, why, what a dream I've had, he muttered. I am glad to wake. He sat up and then he saw that Frodo was lying beside him and slept peacefully, one hand behind his head and the other resting upon the coverlet. It was the right hand, and the third finger was missing. Full memory flooded back, and Sam cried aloud, "It wasn't a dream! Then where are we?"
And a voice spoke softly behind him, "In the land of Ithilien, and in the keeping of the king, and he awaits you." With that, Gandalf stood before him, robed in white, his beard now gleaming like pure snow in the twinkling of the leafy sunlight. "Well, Master Samwise, how do you feel?" he said.
But Sam lay back and stared with open mouth, and for a moment, between bewilderment and great joy, he could not answer. At last he gasped, "Gandalf, I thought you were dead, but then I thought I was dead myself. Is everything sad going to come untrue? What's happened to the world?"
"The great shadow has departed," said Gandalf, and then he laughed, and the sound was like music, or like water in a parched land, and as he listened, the thought came to Sam that he had not heard laughter, the pure sound of merriment, for days upon days without count. It fell upon his ears like the echo of all the joys he had ever known. But he himself burst into tears. Then, as a sweet rain will pass down a wind of spring, and the sun will shine out the clearer, his tears ceased, and his laughter welled up, and laughing, he sprang from his bed.
"How do I feel?" he cried. "Well, I don't know how to say it. I feel, he waved his arms in the air, "I feel like spring after winter, and the sun on the leaves, and like trumpets and harps and all the songs I've ever heard." He stopped and turned towards his master. "But how's Mr. Frodo?" he said. "Isn't it a shame about his poor hand? I hope he's all right otherwise. He had a cruel time."
"Yes, I am all right otherwise," said Frodo, sitting up and laughing in his turn. "I fell asleep again waiting for you, Sam, you sleepy head. I was awake early this morning, and now it must be nearly noon."
"Noon," said Sam, trying to calculate. "Noon of what day?"
"The 14th of the new year," said Gandalf, "or if you like, the 8th day of April in the Shire Reckoning. But in Gondor, the new year will always now begin upon the 25th of March when Sauron fell, and when you were brought out of the fire to the king. He has tended you, and now he awaits you."
All right, Clifford. Feelings on that. Strictly feelings.
So, stunning contrast. Waking up, almost kind of heavenly. It's like magical. Everyone's cloaked in white. You can just, I don't know. I know I'm mixing up probably my mental imagery of the movie, but the feeling of light streaming in,
yeah,
and of this new day dawning is so strong in this whole passage. It feels like that the most amazing feeling of like waking up on a sunny morning and kind of like maybe faintly being aware of things already having happened, but also like the warmth of the sun just feels so powerful. Yeah, very, very evocative, and like just this amazing sigh of relief.
Yeah,
compared to everything that we've been dealing with for at least two books worth of stress and right, drama and everything.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. All right. So this, okay, nothing is going to be worse than the whatever it was, hour and a half conversation about just coming out of just reading the Rings Destruction passage. Mm-hmm. All right, that'll never be topped. but this is going to be a pretty long conversation of what we just read. Okay, maybe second. This might be like second. All right. Okay, so first thing I want to start with is the date. So it's April 8th now, but the ring was destroyed a fortnight ago on March 25th. Okay.
Okay.
So the date here, March 25th, this is one of the two things that really got me in to studying the deeper meaning and symbolism of Lord of the Rings, because this one really blew me away. Okay, this was so, it's, if this didn't exist, our podcast might not exist, because I wouldn't have dived into it so much. Right. Okay. Okay. All right. So, what's the significance of March 25th in real life?
It's around Easter sometimes.
Okay. So, let's get more concrete.
Okay.
Here's a big hint. What comes 9 months later?
Christmas.
Okay. So 9 months later. So what does that mean? The 25th was March 25th. Happened, even if you don't know the name. 9 months. If you're born, what happens to you 9 months before?
Conception. Jesus being conceived.
Right. So Jesus being conceived. that's the Annunciation. So that's when Gabriel appears to Mary to say, all right, you're going to do this, or you've been chosen, right? And then Mary, he doesn't just say you're going to do this. Mary freely says, let it be done to me according to your word, okay? So, and then that's when Jesus is conceived in her womb. Okay, so that's the Annunciation. So that's a big deal, right? Just a refresher, in Lord of the Rings world, what happened on December 25th? I made sure we noted this. It's hard to tell that it was December 25th, but what happened in December based on these timelines? Even if you don't remember exactly December 25th.
December, would that have been Aragorn? No. I don't know, actually. I don't.
All right.
Destruction of Isengard.
No.
How far off am I?
A lot. Okay. All right. We got to go back a little bit then. When did the Fellowship break up? Fellowship? What time of year?
Broke up in the fall, right?
No. They broke up in late February, okay?
Late February, okay.
Okay, so now keep going back. So late February, when did they get to Lothlorien?
Early February.
Right, because they only went a week or 10 days down the river, right?
Right. All right,
Lothlorien, when did they get to Moria?
Did Gandalf die on December 25th?
No. Because they were only at Moria a couple days before Lothlorien, right?
Right, right. Okay. Okay. All right, so that would have been early February.
So then Lothlorien to Rivendell.
The Fellowship was formed on December 25th?
It's set out on December 25th.
Okay. Okay. Okay.
Council of Elrond, they got to Rivendell in October. Council of Elrond was late October. And then they set out on December 25th. So December 25th in the real world, or ancient real world, that was the winter solstice. Now it's December 21st usually, or 20th for us, right? But for the ancient people, I believe it was the 25th in most cultures or something. I don't quite, or the way their calendars worked out, it shook out on that day a lot of times, I guess.
Okay.
So anyways, winter solstice, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Christmas and the Fellowship setting out, if you want to get symbolic with solstice stuff, it's like, all right, this is when the days finally start to get longer. So that's kind of a cosmic sign for hope.
Right.
Basically universally, right? So light enters the world.
And everything.
Right. Okay. So now back to March 25th. All right. Keeping that December 25th ideas in line.
Mm-hmm.
March 25th, Annunciation. God takes incarnate flesh, right? And this is the greatest day of salvation history. All right. This is what I'm laying out here. But not just for that, for many, many more reasons. All right. So in the ancient world, just like the winter solstice was on December 25th, the spring equinox was on March 25th, right?
Right. Okay.
Because that's how it
works. 3 months apart, yeah.
Right. Yeah. Because usually it's on March 21st for us, right? Okay. Mm-hmm. So, first day of spring, and the ancient Jews believe this was the last day of creation. Okay. So, you think about Genesis, right? There's the 7 days of creation. They thought, all right, this is the last one. And that actually is kind of a logical pick, like, all right, spring is when winter's over, you know, that's when things start. And so this is, you know, that is the, now you're in it spring, right?
It's like the beginning of time, kind of.
Right, right. So that's why it's the last day of creation there. Okay. That's how they picked that. It's not like they looked at calendars to try to calculate it. Okay, they didn't do that, right? Okay, this is also traditionally believed to be the day that Abraham spared sacrificing Isaac on the Temple Mount. So that's a very famous story in Genesis. God told Abraham, sacrifice your only son. Mm-hmm. And then God was kind of testing him, because then he tells him, don't do it at the last second, right? Mm-hmm. And they said, another lamb will be provided, right? Or God will provide the lamb or something, right? Mm-hmm. Additionally, this is believed to be the date that Moses led the Hebrews out of Egypt when they were enslaved in Exodus. Okay, so this is a big day. So you're seeing like all these things, they just all happen on March 25th. This is crazy.
Right. Okay.
Okay. Apparently, and this one, I don't know how you would find it besides that just everything happens on the day. Apparently, this is the day that Adam and Eve fell. Okay.
Okay.
I'll go with it, I guess. But there's no way anybody could ever know that. I guess you just assume everything happens on March 25th, right? That's the only reason behind that one, I would assume. And most importantly, if Moses led the people out of Egypt from slavery on that day, what probably happened around that time as well, related to Moses?
Pentecost Or,
close. Passover is what you're thinking of.
Oh, sorry. Excuse me.
That's where they have to sacrifice the lambs, you know, and then
put
the blood on the door, because that's when the angel of death passes over them. But it strikes the Egyptian firstborns, and that's how they get out, right? Because Pharaoh's like, get out of here. I don't want to see you guys. Okay, so anyways, if Passover was around there, what do you think might have also happened on this March 25th day in, how do I give the hint? Anyways, well, if Passover happened on it, what do you think else happened on it? Think more around the Annunciation, I guess. Or in that generation, let's say.
Okay. Well, am I too late to say Jesus is resurrected on the 25th?
Not the resurrection. The church fathers believe this was the actual date of Good Friday, right? So the crucifixion, okay? They believe this is the day that it happened. All right, so Easter and Good Friday, they're movable feasts now because they're based on the lunar calendar, so like on the moon, right? But based on tradition, theology, and, you know, hopefully this goes back to eyewitness accounts and memories, the date that he died on the cross was on Good Friday, was March 25th, okay? And that's definitely what Tolkien was operating under when he wrote this scene here. Okay. Because I think originally in the drafts, I didn't double check it, but originally in the drafts, the way everything was lining up, they were going to either destroy the ring on the 15th or the 21st, but he purposely finagled the timing so that everything would line up for the 25th for this reason, because he wanted to do this, right? Mm-hmm. So Tom Shippey says, by mentioning the date, Tolkien is presenting his eucatastrophe as a forerunner or type of the greater one of the Christian myth, okay? So that's what he's trying to do with this March 25th. Anyways, I don't know. Like, that fact just blew me away that Tolkien got that granular to do that.
Right,
and it's like most people don't even know that March 25th is traditionally the Good Friday. You know, I mean, it's crazy, right? But it's like, oh, look at how deep this guy went down to such levels, right?
Although you could look at it from the other way around, that if this date has so much significance for the Bible and the Catholic Christian tradition, that if Tolkien was trying to draw any sort of loose connection, it's almost like, how could he not pick that day, right?
Right. But, that's why it's good that he did. I mean, he might have seen as he was writing out the timelines and everything, because, I mean, he had him getting to Rivendell in October, and then he had him setting out in December, January. So then it was kind of like, oh, well, I'm really close. Why don't I just do it? Let's do March 25th. Right. I have to pick this day, right? So, but anyways, this, like I said, this was one of the things that really, 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 I don't know. It was just, maybe it's not that significant to everybody else, but it was just one of those things that's like, whoa, that was a glass-shattering moment, how much is really in these books, you know, all the symbolism and how deep he went with it, right?
Right.
Anyways, if March 25th, Mount Doom chapter had big, huge Good Friday vibes, this chapter has quite a few Easter Sunday vibes, I would have to say. So that was a Good Friday. You know, they conquered sin and death. They destroyed, you know, on the cross, destroying the ring, right? This is, all right, now we get to Easter.
Okay.
Oh, and just to let you know, I checked this. I'm going to cut this part out. I checked this. Because Easter's so late this year, I have just enough weeks that if I don't take any weeks off editing, I can put out the Mount Doom chapter on Good Friday, and I can put this one out on Easter Sunday. Great. All right.
Nice
well,
work.
I have to kill myself to get this done. Like, so there's no break. Usually I would take the break after the, you know, between the books, but no. All right, I don't get to do it, so it's just like, all right, whatever. This has to get. I can't. I just like this. Just like you just said, I can't miss this opportunity. So. Okay, so heavy Easter vibes. Gandalf's talking about there's a king of the land now, right? We'll get to him later. But notably, he healed Frodo and Sam, okay?
Right.
Another thing that we don't have to really talk about again, because we kind of talked about it last time, a shadow has departed, not the shadow, right?
Right.
Signifying.
Right. Sauron, but the fact that evil has not ceased to exist.
Right, right. They've destroyed it for their generation, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, or they've destroyed a really big one in their lifetime, but there's still other evils that will crop up.
It's not the end of history.
Right, right. And evil's immortal to an extent, right? Okay, so now this is the next thing I want to talk about. To start this scene, whose point of view is the narration from?
Sam, for the most part.
Right. Okay, so if you only read Fellowship of the Ring and then you jump to this point, you would probably be surprised that this narration's from Sam's point of view and not Frodo's, right?
Right. Absolutely.
The movie also did decide to go from Frodo's perspective for this scene too. Uh-huh. Right? So, Clifford, why Sam? Was it just sentimental feelings? Or, you know, because Frodo had actually already woken up before him, too. That's the other thing that was said here. Okay? So why Sam?
Well, we've talked before about Tolkien's sort of preference to pick the most underdog character, or the least important, not the least important, but the kind of lowliest character in the bunch to narrate scenes from. It's a consistent pattern. And in this case, we know Sam is sort of the lowest, or he's kind of the underdog to Frodo in a way. And then also the fact that he's waking up later, Tolkien's got this like narrative preference, I think, to like have the narrator show up to the scene last and have things unfold before them versus being very omniscient and watching everything happen from above.
Okay. So
that's one thing I feel like. Then secondly is like, I think that there's, or at least my feeling reading this was Frodo has entered this new state of being in some way.
Okay.
That he's become a little bit less relatable, not in a bad way, but he has a glow around him. Like he's partially like out of this world now in a way that Sam is not. Sam is like totally our reliable, grounded narrator who's totally relatable and is like waking up confused and remembering his childhood and thinking about the future. Whereas Frodo seems to be in almost like a dreamlike state, dare I say, like heavenly state or something. That's my
take. Is Sam not? Come on, he was. That's the most excited he's ever been.
Sam's overjoyed, but it feels very human.
That's right.
The celebration of his humanness.
I'm trying to be a little bit devil's advocate with you. And here's the biggest thing for devil's advocate. Frodo's been the guy. He was the ring bearer. He made it all the way there. He didn't quite do it himself, but we kind of came to the conclusion there's no way he could have. And Tolkien basically said that in letters, right? Okay. Mm-hmm. But he got the job done. Not really thanks to him at the very end. But he's been the guy. He fulfilled the quest, or the quest has been fulfilled at least. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he can celebrate that. If there was ever a time where, I don't know, it should kind of be his perspective, you would think it'd be now, especially after everything we saw. I think back to Bag End Chapter 2, where it's him and Gandalf discussing the whole fate of the ring, and it's like, now they've done it. But we don't get the kind of third-person narration of Frodo's feelings of it and everything. And it's like, yeah, you're right. Heavenly thing, Sam's the lowest character, lowest perspective, whatnot. But, like, come on. Does it somewhat feel like we didn't, I don't know, it's, he's leaving
you,
us hanging.
You want to hear it from Frodo's end to wrap up the story fully.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, I would say that, yeah.
That's fair.
All right. But anyways, I think there's another reason why Tolkien chose Sam.
Okay.
So, to get into this, I'm going to give you another hint why I think this.
Okay.
So, Clifford, back in normal times, back in the Shire, what is Sam's profession?
He's a gardener.
Okay. Easter vibes. Beyond just springtime. Ideas?
The gardeners are tending to springtime and everything blooming in the spring, perhaps.
Right, but beyond the springtime feel. Easter vibes. How it connect gardeners, Easter.
Something to do with burial? No?
Pretty good. All right, pretty good. Okay. So, maybe, I don't know, if anybody's thinking, Yes, there's Garden of Eden references. Yes, there's Garden of Gethsemane references. All right. But when Jesus is resurrected on Easter Sunday, the first documented eyewitness who sees him is Mary Magdalene, who mistakes him for a gardener.
Okay.
So what I think is going on here is, after reading 900 pages about how Aragorn is a type of Christ the King, after reading 900 pages about how Gandalf is a type of Christ the Prophet, and after reading 900 pages of how Frodo is a type of Christ the High Priest, and we understand to the sacrifice, right?
Mm-hmm.
After 900 pages, with all that in mind, Tolkien, I think, is now laying it on thick that this whole time, Sam, as the gardener, quietly and in disguise, has also been a type of Christ, okay?
Mm.
In fact, Tolkien is quoted in his letters as saying, Sam is the chief hero of the Lord of the Rings.
Whoa.
It's not Frodo, it's not Gandalf, it's not Aragorn. Okay.
I thought that. I had no idea Tolkien had ever said anything to that effect.
Right. Well, so that's the thing. All right, here's the thing. Let me jump on that too. There are so many things that we think, but we don't ever articulate, okay?
Right.
To where, you know, there's this famous quote, I think it's from Socrates, I almost forget, and it almost doesn't matter for the exact same reason I'm about to say. It's that all knowledge is memory quote. Like, there's so many things that's like, I already implicitly know that. Like, all of us already implicitly know Sam was the biggest hero of Lord of the Rings. But right. It makes a big deal still when Tolkien himself says, oh, Sam's the chief hero of Lord of the Rings.
Right.
You know, right. It's like, now it's explicitly there, but it's like, but we already knew it. You know, so it's like, do we already have it in our memories? Did we hear it somewhere and we forgot it and now we're relearning it? You know, it's like, that, I don't know, that kind of stuff. It's just, it's crazy. But yeah, I don't know. I think this is, Tolkien said it. It's in one of his letters. How about I don't read it, because it's a slight spoiler? Because the problem is he's not directly talking about it. He literally just says Sam, and then he says in parentheses, he's the chief hero.
Okay.
You know, but he doesn't take time to actually break that out in writing. I'm sure he did in his mind. I'm sure he had conversations with people, maybe even wrote it down somewhere that we just
it's
don't
it's not
have
a statement of. It's like an aside or something.
Yeah, it's literally a parenthetical. So okay. But anyways, he said it, and it's on pages 160 and 161 in Letters of J.R.R. Tolkien, if anybody's looking for it. You'll find it there. Okay. It also reminded me too of like that Gandalf line about hobbits. It's like, oh, there's, you can know all there is to know about them in a month, and yet they could still surprise you, right? All right. So it's, you know, this is Sam. This is the fun twist. Sam, most of all, right? He's the hobbitest hobbit ever. So we already read last time too that I read part of the suffering servant passage that's from Isaiah. It's Isaiah 52 and 53, the chapters. The big takeaways there were, like, it's brutal suffering, but the hero's kind of in disguise, you know, whoever the suffering servant is.
Okay.
So we've already seen, like, if you read it again, but again, it's Isaiah 52 and 53. It's extremely applicable to Aragorn when we meet him in Bree. You know, he's the hero in disguise and looks really crummy. Probably fits with Gandalf the Grey pretty well. And then I would also say, too, because we brought it up the last chapter, Frodo really puts the suffering and suffering servant, you know? But I would say, most of all, Sam puts the servant and suffering servant more than all these other guys who have ultimately been servants to God's providence or ultimately Iluvatar within the context of the story, you know?
Because right,
that's how
right.
the ring got destroyed, right?
In other words, Sam is much more explicitly a servant to that cause.
Or like... the most tangible, practical, obvious servant, you know, because
right.
he was a servant to Frodo, but then he was also a servant to every, you know, all the hidden powers as well. Right. There was also, though, when I read the suffering servant passage, it's just, there's a element of surprise and unexpectedness too. And I think hobbits totally fulfill that, but specifically Sam, most of all.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
I buy it.
Thoughts on that? Feelings? Sam, hero? I mean, you said you already kind of knew it, but...
Yeah, it's something that I've internalized, but it still feels a little surprising to hear, like, officially stated.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, so, yeah. But that's the thing. Like, the movie doesn't go for it. The movie does make it Frodo when they show him first, you know? But it's, oh, it's Sam.
Yeah, it's an interesting way of looking at things, because it's, as we talked about in the past few chapters, Sam is, like, his own sacrifice is very, it's, like, pretty complete. Frodo may be physically suffering more and in more pain, but it's Sam's constant selflessness that is what is driving the quest forwards.
Yeah.
Frodo has to make a big sacrifice, but as we noted, his selflessness and sense of duty did falter a little bit, whereas Sam's basically never falters. So it is an interesting take that I pretty much agree with.
Yeah. So Aragorn's the king. Gandalf's the prophet. Frodo's the priest. Sam's the servant, the companion, the friend, with you through the end, through all of it, never alone, and I absolutely love it. It's pretty great.
Cool. And also, I feel like that fits kind of like Frodo becomes less relatable over time, just like you were describing his priestly characteristics and his broader sense of sacrifice start to come out. He becomes more apart from the reader, I think, in the way we might think of a priest being like separate from a layperson.
All right, so we're gonna have a couple more chapters get into this too, but why do you think that is?
I don't know if I can articulate it very well, but I feel like there's always an idea that priests are in touch with the divine in a direct way. And part of that means they're a little bit more removed from normal life. Like they're okay, holding this in-between status in the way that they're communicating with God and communicating with people.
Okay, and then based on the, forget like the priest delusions too, just from the story, why would he be more aloof at this point?
Because he's had to interact with these grander forces at play in the world. Like seeing Sauron, witnessing the destruction of Sauron, feeling basically the mission of Gandalf and Aragorn and all of them to change the course of the entire world that ultimately ties back to the Valar and Iluvatar and probably some sense of divine providence that's coming from Iluvatar.
Well, I would even say more so the quest and specifically the ring really just has taken a lot out of him.
Yeah,
it's taken its toll, you know. I mean, he seems a lot better than he did on the way to Mount Doom and Mordor, but I don't know. We can get into if we think he's completely healed.
It's degraded his humanity or something like that. Like
he's definitely changed.
Whole,
you know,
the whole thing about him not having memories of specific feelings and emotions. That's like it's carved away at what would be his like normal human experience of the world.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So I still got more with this too. Okay. So Sam, when he woke up and he's talking to Gandalf, he can't believe it all happened, right? Mm-hmm. But he knows it did all happen because he saw Frodo's wounded hand. So, yes. In relation to Easter, what function does Frodo's hand play?
Resurrected Jesus.
Yes,
and
yes.
The disciples trying to understand if they're seeing just a ghost or an apparition or something, or seeing the real thing, and seeing the nail holes in Jesus' hands, right, are the kind of the proof that it's reality.
Right. So just like a side note, lots of people have commented, biblical scholars and stuff, they thought that's not really even a human detail, that he would still have the wounds, a resurrected Jesus. It's like, if somebody was just kind of making this up, you would make the resurrected person, if they're really glorified, you know, they'd be powerful, they'd be invincible, they wouldn't have any weaknesses at all, but that's not the case. Like, Jesus clearly has the wounds to the point where when he appears to the apostles first, one of them, Thomas, is missing. That's the famous story where Thomas comes back and everybody's like, we just saw Jesus. And Thomas is like, nope, I'm not going to believe that until I touch his wounds myself, you know. And then there's, you can look it up, the Caravaggio painting, Doubting Thomas, where, you know, he's literally sticking his finger in the side of Jesus, you know, because he's got the nail wounds and stuff, but then he's got the wound in the side where he was stabbed with the spear. And yeah, I mean, it's, I don't know, one of the most iconic paintings ever. But yeah, so I think that's what Frodo's finger is functioning as here, right? Yeah, Frodo's hand, it's evidence that it all really happened. But Sam thought Gandalf was dead. He thought he himself was dead. And he has that great line, is everything sad going to come untrue? Okay? Why did Jesus appear as a gardener to Mary Magdalene? Do you have any idea? Because she's the first witness to see him. There's a practical reason, and then there's a bunch of symbolic reasons.
Practical.
You kind of said it when you were guessing originally.
It's in the graveyard, and the gardener would be tending to a grave.
Yeah. So it's near a stone tomb. I don't know if it was actually in a graveyard. But yeah, there was a garden near there, so he was just gardening. so that's the one thing. But okay, what's he? You know. These things, it's like, all right, it's not just this practical purpose. This is, you know, this is the greatest story ever. This is the true myth, right? Okay, so there's going to be 200% symbolism or infinite symbolism, right? And 200% is probably a low estimate. so there's going to be infinite symbolism, and it's the true thing that happened. So God, creator, created the Garden of Eden. Jesus... resurrection is basically like new everything. Like Jesus is the new Adam, he's the new Moses, he's the new David, he's the new high priest. All right, he's the gardener. He's saying, I'm God, I created this, and now it's like it's time for, I don't know, like, well, new, you know. So it's like this is the new Eden, all right? You know, and one of like my favorite Bible quotes ever, I think Revelation is, behold, I make all things new. And that's also the best line of the Passion of the Christ movie. So if anybody watches that, look for that line. Comes at an awesome spot, pretty great. Anyways, I thought, like, Jesus as the gardener, it's like, yes, all right, is everything sad coming untrue at Easter? Yeah, it's definitely a signpost, foretaste that, yeah, this is what's coming. And then this is what it's, how it's, this scene's functioning in Lord of the Rings as well. Okay, so like this is, you know, you said the scene was heavenly, that was your first feeling about it, and it's like yep, that's completely correct. All right. So this is the foretaste of like that final victory. We've said history's one long defeat 100 times. All right. This is the foretaste of the final victory that does defeat that long defeat. Right. To go back to Leaf by Niggle, cause we already did that at this point. You remember in his lifetime, he made one really good detailed leaf.
Right.
And he had the rest of the picture with the tree and the mountains in the background all in his head. This is the this is like kind of the really good leaf. And then in the next life is going to be the detailed tree that this leaf is pointing to, you know?
Okay.
So again, this is obviously it's a continuation. Actually, it's debatable if this is a continuation of the last Eucatastrophe moment when they destroyed the ring in the last chapter, or if this is a second new one, which we can get into. We can get into that with the next chunk that we have to read. But as we're kind of going to see, everything sad, you know, it's not yet going to come untrue. All right. So we actually still have, I don't know, 80 pages of the book left. And a lot happens. Okay. So just because the ring's destroyed doesn't mean the story's over. Right. And Tolkien has also harped before, the true fairy stories never end. So, you know, remember Sam and Frodo, before they went into the Tunnel of Cirith Ungol, like they, you know, Sam realized, hey, we're still in the same story as Beren and Lúthien. You know, that thing's still going on, even though they're long, long, long dead, like 6,000 years dead, you know?
Right.
They're still in the same story. So all that, just to keep in mind. Also, last thing to hammer home about the Easter foretaste theme. I cut you off, but you were already onto it. Ithilien is the
Garden of Gondor, right?
Yep.
Okay. It was this garden land, and that's part of the reason it was so resonant in Sam's mind when they passed through the first time.
Yep. So just more New Eden signposts, basically.
Sam the gardener waking up in the garden of the restored kingdom. Mm-hmm.
All right, so they're going to go meet the new King of Gondor, and Sam really somehow doesn't know what to expect, but I guess, I don't know, he's had a long month. Yeah. I'll give him that, so.
I think it's like a little bit comical, which I'm sure is intentional on Tolkien's part, that they don't know what's going on.
Well, I think, see, it doesn't say, but I think Frodo knows what's going on.
Okay, yeah.
Frodo kind of Sam doesn't, it. Yeah.
Right, which is a little comical, but we have to, if we put it in the context of what Sam was observing about everything going down, Sam was there for Moria and Lothlorien, but has missed all the other plot developments with Aragorn since then.
That's true, but he was at the Council of Elrond, and it was laid out, hey, Aragorn's the king. Now, Pippin didn't know that when they got to Minas Tirith. I get
arguably,
that.
The other hobbits weren't actually properly attending the Council of Elrond and were just eavesdropping and tagging along at the very end, right?
No, Sam, I believe, was eavesdropping the whole time. The other two actually didn't. Okay. Didn't do anything. So. And so Pippin really didn't seem to understand that when they got to Minas Tirith, even though Aragorn's walking around with this fancy sword and there's, I don't know, whatever. Sam, it's like, the reason it's kind of unacceptable is because Sam's been a boss running the show, you know, when Frodo couldn't. I mean, he's the chief hero of the story. You'd think he'd somewhat be wiser to this now because he's matured so much, but whatever. Mm-hmm. I guess we could go with it and it's totally fine. That's just a very ticky-tacky thing. Okay. Gandalf says the highest honor would be wearing the traveling clothes that you wore into Mordor, because Sam's really wondering what he's supposed to wear to meet a king. And so wearing the rags, theoretically and symbolically, I get it, you know?
Right.
But
I was surprised, though, Gandalf doesn't even say that they should wear even the orc rags that you wore.
I know. That's what I'm saying. Like, I get it in theory, but in practice, come on, why don't I just wear something clean? Like,
yeah,
do we have to do the symbolism stuff? You know, come on.
Using the cloaks from Lothlorien, like the symbolic good clothing that protected them along the way. But the orc rags were like, actually terrible and smelly and didn't fit them.
Right. Like, symbolically, I can't articulate it fully, but I get why you'd wear that, but in practice, it's just, ugh, no, I would never want to see this again. Just burn it. Get out of here. Don't save these as heirloom things. Just get rid of them.
Yeah,
if you
Gandalf's
can find my cooking
like,
gear.
Gandalf's like, we're going to put this in a glass case.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So at this point, Gandalf also returns Galadriel's gifts to Frodo and Sam because they picked him up when the eagles found him. This isn't really relevant besides that. What are the gifts again? We should keep this in mind.
The file of Galadriel for Frodo.
Okay. And what's Sam's?
And then Sam's is a little box, which I believe has a small bit of soil from Lothlorien.
Oh, yeah. He got the dirt. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's his gift. Okay.
Uh-huh.
All right.
But, I mean, this is maybe overly obvious from what we were just talking about, but I feel like those gifts actually align with what we were just talking about, like Frodo as priest and Sam as gardener. Like gardener, dirt, literally, but it's also like the dirt is from Lothlorien is kind of like fertilizer to bring new life for Sam to like go out into the world and use that. So it's kind of like a not resurrection, but like bringing new life goes hand in hand with the spring thing. And then Frodo,
you're entirely spoiling.
Okay, I'll slow down.
No, keep going, it's fine.
And then Frodo with the light of Galadriel, even though we know Sam was using it for very practical purposes in the last couple chapters, it kind of makes sense as a priest that they're like a guiding light for their people, you know, that there's like some form of bringing light to where there is darkness.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's a better way to say that, but I feel like that's kind of part of a priest role, which so it makes sense that Frodo gets that file.
Yeah. All right. So, wherever in Ithilien they are, Tolkien's busting out the most perfect and ideal descriptions he can possibly work up, which means he's in the top percentile of human authors ever. So they're walking through this archway of trees, and they come out to this beautiful green lawn. Assume the sun shining, absolutely clear blue skies, right? Something to keep in mind when we read, as we go through the rest of this chapter, and Peter Crave pointed this out, this chapter is very liturgical, okay? So it really, you know, everything's perfectly ordered, perfectly timed, just right. There's processions, communal praise, storytelling, feasts and banquets. Okay, so just keep that in mind for the rest of this, right? This is it's an excellent point that he brought up. You want to start this one?
Sure. As they came to the opening in the wood, they were surprised to see knights in bright mail and tall guards in silver and black standing there, who greeted them with honor and bowed before them. And then one blew a long trumpet, and they went on through the aisle of trees beside the singing stream. So they came to a wide green land, and beyond it was a broad river in a silver haze, out of which rose a long wooded isle, and many ships lay by its shores. But on the field where they now stood, a great host was drawn up, in ranks and companies glittering in the sun. And as the hobbits approached, swords were unsheathed, and spears were shaken, and horns and trumpets sang, and men cried with many voices and in many tongues. Long live the halflings! Praise them with great praise! Cui e Ferinan anan, Aglar e Ferinath! Praise them with great praise, Frodo and Samwise! Daur aberel, Conin e Anun, Eglerio! Praise them, Eglerio! Alaitete, laitete, andave latuvalamet. Praise them. Cormacolindar, alaite tariana. Praise them. The ring bearers, praise them with great praise.
And so the red blood, blushing their faces and their eyes shining with wonder, Frodo and Sam went forward and saw that amidst the clamorous host were set three high seats built of green turfs. Behind the seat upon the right floated, white on green, a great horse running free. Upon the left was a banner, silver upon blue, a ship swan-proud, faring on the sea. But behind, the highest throne in the midst of all the great standard was spread in the breeze, and there was a white tree flowered upon a sable field beneath a shining crown and seven glittering stars. On the throne sat a mail-clad man. A great sword lay across his knees, but he wore no helm. As they drew near, he rose, and then they knew him. Changed as he was, so high and glad of face, kingly, lord of men, dark-haired, with eyes of gray. Frodo ran to meet him, and Sam followed close behind. "Well, if this isn't the crown of all," he said, "Strider, or I'm still asleep."
"Yes, Sam, Strider," said Aragorn. "It is a long way, is it not, from Bree, where you did not like the look of me? A long way for all of us, but yours has been the darkest road."
And then, to Sam's surprise and utter confusion, he bowed his knee before them, and taking them by the hand, Frodo upon his right and Sam upon his left, he led them to the throne, and setting them upon it, he turned to the men and captains who stood by and spoke, so that his voice rang over all the hosts, crying,
"Praise them with great praise."
And when the glad shout had swelled up and died away, to Sam's final and complete satisfaction and pure joy, a minstrel of Gondor stood forth and knelt, and begged leave to sing. And behold, he said,
"Lo, lords and knights and men of valor, unashamed, kings and princes and fair people of Gondor, and riders of Rohan, and you sons of Elrond and Dúnedain of the North, and elf and dwarf and great hearts of the Shire, and all free folk of the West, now listen to my lay, for I will sing to you of Frodo of the Nine Fingers and the Ring of Dún."
And when Sam heard that, he laughed aloud for sheer delight, and he stood up and cried, "O great glory and splendor, and all my wishes have come true." And then he wept.
And all the host laughed and wept, and in the midst of their merriment and tears, the clear voice of the minstrel rose like silver and gold, and all men were hushed. And he sang to them, now in the elven tongue, now in the speech of the West, until their hearts, wounded with sweet words, overflowed, and their joy was like swords, and they passed in thought out to regions where pain and delight flow together and tears are the very wine of blessedness.
Wow. All right. Clifford, we don't have to get into the feelings here because I'm going to have examples of feelings. But this is in the running by itself. I asked you last time, I'm going to make the cut here. This is in the running for greatest You Catastrophe moments of the trilogy, of all of Lord of the Rings, okay? So, top You Catastrophe moments, or any You Catastrophe moments throughout the series. Let's rattle through them. What do we got?
Gandalf dying.
Coming back is the
coming
moment.
Back. Well, yeah, okay.
So just only say the good part.
Okay. Gandalf coming back from apparent death.
Okay, hold on. Let me cross this one off the list. Gandalf returns.
Gandalf returns. The easy one just happened now. Destruction of the Ring.
Okay, Mount Doom. Got it.
The Riders of Rohan saving the day on the fields of Gondor.
Okay. Yep. Yep. When the Witch King's at the gates, right?
Right. I don't know if you can, if you would group Aragorn passing through the paths of the dead with that.
I would say
that's kind of all one culmination.
His comes when he gets out of the ships, I would say.
Okay.
In Gondor. Yeah. So that's okay. The chapter after the riders get there.
Arrival of the good guys on the fields of Gondor.
Well, there was two moments there. When Rohan came as one, and then when Aragorn got out of the ships, that's the second.
Okay. I don't know.
Black Gate. Come on. We just read it at the beginning of this chapter.
Oh, yeah. Well, I grouped that in with the destruction.
No, I don't. The Eagles coming to the Black Gate's a separate one.
Okay. Eagles coming to the Black Gate at the time of the armies of Mordor falling apart.
Okay.
The captains of the West winning battle.
Okay. The other ones I wrote down, when Bilbo and the dwarves are saved by wargs in The Hobbit, the Eagles come again there, right? Okay, so that's one. Then obviously the Battle of Five Armies for Bilbo in The Hobbit. Okay, and then from Fellowship, when Frodo's crossing the river into Rivendell and the Nine Ringwraiths are chasing him, then the river comes and washes him over. That's definitely got to be one. Okay. And potentially you could say the next chapter where he just wakes up and everybody's happy in Rivendell. Maybe that's one. I don't know. Not so much. Anyways, last one, though, definitely is Helm's Deep, Gandalf's Entrance.
Okay.
And then there's this. So, and we'll just count this whole chapter as one. But in Tolkien's opinion and C.S. Lewis's opinion, I believe they would say this one takes the cake. It's somewhere in Tolkien's letters that it's on, that he said on record that him and C.S. Lewis cried when they read this scene. Like, he gave this to C.S. Lewis and at the bar, and C.S. Lewis was reading it, and when he got here to this part, he wept. He weeps where Sam weeps here, okay? And so, I don't know. It gets kind of, you know, and you read the scene, everybody's weeping.
Yeah.
I mean, what's the deal? What is with all this crying and stuff? So
yeah, that was an interesting thing I was going to say from reading it. Like, it's kind of like they're saying tears of joy, but it's not actually tears of joy. Like, they're actually like weeping tears of sadness and pain at the same time that they're celebrating feelings of joy. Yeah. Like, it's a very unique thing that is being described of like simultaneous pain and glory and joy and everything all at once.
Yeah. Okay. So let's let some, people who got paid to write books about this give some input to help clear it up. Articulate better, you know, what we're trying to say that we're onto. Like, we already know this, Clifford. All knowledge is memory. But
all knowledge is memory.
I really do think that at some points. But anyways, all right. So Fleming Rutledge, she says, Tolkien said later that he spilled tears on the page as he wrote the scene of the welcome of Frodo and Sam on the field of Cormallen. Joy, and that's where they are, Cormallen. I don't think that was ever said, but that's the chapter title too. Okay. Joy and tears are closely related. This is partly a relieving flood of dammed up emotions. Also, however, this is a sense of what ought to be compared to what is, that is acutely painful even when joy is at its height. Okay. Let me add on Tom Shippey's quote, and then you can start to break this apart. Tom Shippey says, Frodo and Sam react in much the same way after the destruction of the ring, while they're still in Mordor. They, too, think that they are as good as dead, and furthermore, that this is exactly what one might have expected. Frodo indeed brings up, but rejects the idea of a compulsory happy ending, saying seriously, it's like all things in the world, hope fails and end comes. We are lost in ruin and downfall, and there is no escape. He turns out to be wrong, of course. But there is no denying the force of what he says as a general rule. Thoughts. Break that apart.
The last bit, there is joy in Frodo and Sam being saved, and yet pain in knowing that hope does come to an end, and there is still death in the world.
Rutledge is... quote might help you a bit if you remember what I said. There's a sense of what ought to be compared to what is that is acutely painful even when joy is at its height.
So it's like they're maybe in simple terms, they were expecting to die and then they didn't. And so they're understanding, they're seeing their own death at the same time as they're seeing their own salvation, maybe, is one piece of it. So like what ought to be is what they think might have happened to them had everything continued its course.
Yeah.
And then there's like this miraculous, unbelievable shift where they're still living. And that is joyous, but it's mixed with pain because they see like a parallel version of things.
Yeah, Sauron should have won. Denethor calculated it out. Sauron should have won.
Mm-hmm.
They should all be dead by now, but with great joy, they're not. I mean, Sam says, right, everything's sad going to come untrue. I mean, you know, like it's unbelievable that they succeeded, but they are aware that this really shouldn't even be the case, right? We should not have been able to pull this off, but we did somehow, right?
Yeah.
Joseph Pierce, he's got the good line here that he basically pulls this from Tolkien's own essay on fairy stories. And he says, the Yue catastrophic tale is the true form of fairy tale in its highest function. This good catastrophe, this sudden joyous turn representing a miraculous grace never to be counted on to reoccur, did not deny the existence of discatastrophe, of sorrow and failure. On the contrary, the possibility of these is necessary to the joy of deliverance. Rather, it denied the universal final defeat, and insofar is Evangelium giving a fleeting glimpse of joy, joy beyond the walls of the world, poignant as grief. It is the mark of a good fairy story, of the higher or more complete kind, that however wild its events, however fantastic or terrible the adventures, it can give to a child or a man that hears it, when the turn comes, a catch of the breath, a beat and lifting of the heart, near to or indeed accompanied by tears, as keen as that given by any form of literary art and having a peculiar quality.
Hmm.
Thoughts on all that?
So, some of it, we've talked about this a little bit before, like the idea of contrast and needing one thing to see the other. That's what I'm picking up here. You need the discatastrophe, or the prospect of discatastrophe, for the Yue catastrophe to be truly joyous.
Yeah.
And not just a good thing.
Yeah.
And specifically, I like that idea, the joy of deliverance as a concept. It's like that's what everyone's experiencing right now. It's not just like happiness stemming from the fact that they're in a nice place and a good thing has happened, but the joy of deliverance. Like, it's only that the sensation of being like pulled out of their, or being saved from their own destruction, that's this like extraordinarily powerful sensation of joy. And then the joy beyond the walls of the world, I feel like, is something they're sensing, a glimpse of what's beyond. Like
it's a foretaste or signpost again.
Right. Yeah. To what you've talked about before. Like, if this is a prelude to like a final salvation or something like that, this is that sensation.
Yeah.
And that's part of why it's like sad and beautiful and joyous at the same time.
Yeah. So this is, I don't know. This is that I guess is kind of the case for why Tolkien and C.S. Lewis would say this is the greatest Yue catastrophe moment probably of the whole Lord of the Rings, I would guess. But
fair.
Okay, only other thing that I really thought about here with this thing was, I mean, you were reading, excellent job with the song too, Clifford. That was a lot of Elvish. That was pretty tough.
So I mangled it.
No. See, here's the thing. If you say it with confidence, it goes a long way. It just goes such a long way.
Steamroller. Not slowing down on this one.
So, anyways, though, the praise them with great praise might be a chapter premature, but it reminded me of the Crown Him with Many Crowns song. That's like a hymn. You'd sing it like Christ is the King. So, like, when he's crowned, you know, and I don't know. I think British people are into it because they're still about monarchies and stuff. So, anyways, that's what that reminded me of, too. But at the end of the day here, they're praising two hobbits. You know, they saw this mission through, the most important aspect of it. They did it. They get all the praise. Peter Kraft has this good quote here, because, I mean, we could talk about it, but let me just succinctly have him say some stuff. Okay. So sure. He says, in The Lord of the Rings, the hobbits appear at first to be only comic contrast to the larger and more heroic men and elves. Yet almost all the great deeds are achieved by hobbits, very much in the style of the god Tolkien believes in. Tolkien raises up the lowly to put down the lordly. The Lord of the Rings is the perfect illustration of Mary's Magnificat. If you want to find the Magnificat, it's Luke 146 to 155, okay? Peter Graves says, work it out for yourselves verse by verse, so we'll also let you do with it. unless I play it. I don't know. We'll see. Okay. Anyways, God did the same sort of thing as Tolkien did over and over again in history. The people he chose were more like hobbits than like wizards or elves. And he goes on to list. He lists Abraham. He lists Jacob. He lists Joseph. He lists Moses. He lists David. And then, you know, read his book for those ones. But then he says, the 12 apostles were hobbit-like peasants, and God made them saints. And the greatest example of all, his supreme revelation of himself, was a tiny embryo, then a tiny baby born amid cow dung, who grew up to become an unemployed wanderer in a hick town and a crucified criminal. The stone which the builders rejected has become the cornerstone.
Hmm.
Thoughts on all that?
It's like I feel like we already have talked about you catastrophe a lot, but it's like you catastrophic arc to the story. Like,
yeah.
This like tremendous inversion of what everything would seem to be to like how it's like inverted and elevated.
Yeah, I mean, it's Tolkien, he goes on to say it in that Fairy Stories essay, and then Joseph Pierce gets at it well in his books too. But you know, that's the greatest eucatastrophe, is Christ coming into the world, and then the eucatastrophe within Christ's life is the resurrection, obviously, after the, you know, so it's a eucatastrophe within the eucatastrophe, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
Story within the story, you know? but I think like what I actually take away as the most important part of this is, okay, so hobbits get this done. I can never remember it, but we quoted it at the beginning of the chapter, but there's the small hands move the wheels of the world when the mighty look elsewhere, you know?
Okay.
That was that Elrond quote from the Council of Elrond.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought the most significant part of that quote that from Peter Kraft here was the people he chooses, they're more like hobbits. The people that God chooses are more like hobbits than wizards. It's like, all right, you know, he's not taking the best people to get the job done. He's just taking, you know, he can do this kind of with anybody almost, or he's taking very ordinary people who, you know, then they can go and do these extraordinary things. Right.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, which again, we've known this the whole book. We read the whole book. Like, this is what we already implicitly know by this point, but then you just hear somebody say it and it's just, yep. All right. Now I can also articulate that based on what you know, now that I read it, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
All right, but yeah, we can keep moving on. The rest of this chapter is pretty downhill, or well, metaphorically downhill in an easy way, not a bad way, you know. So we can kind of blow through some stuff here. All right, so they're getting ready to have a feast that evening, and Frodo and Sam, now they get to change into nice clothes, right? So to Frodo's surprise, Gandalf gives him back the elven cloak, the sword, and the mithril vest, because those were taken at Cirith Ungol, and then obviously Gandalf got him back from that messenger at the mouth of Sauron.
Black Gate.
Yeah, right. Frodo now, he refuses to accept the sword, but Gandalf says he should at least wear it for the evening, which Frodo relents to. And then kind of minorly shockingly, even though we're kind of chromatose at this point to all like the awesome stuff going on, Gandalf's the squire for them, you know, he's the one that puts the sword belts on him and stuff. So it was worth a couple comments. We don't have to dwell on it too long, but remember on the way to Mount Doom, when they ditched all their gear, Frodo said, I'm never going to wield a weapon again. So that's kind of right. where that idea is coming from. I'm not going to put on this sword. So right. has Frodo become a pacifist?
Interesting. I don't know if he would totally qualify as a pacifist. I feel like two different things. One could be like he's fought the battle of his age and it's done now. So yeah. there's no point to fight further. And then two is like he's maybe not a pacifist, but he doesn't see the value in wielding a petty weapon like a sword for some like minor interpersonal conflict. Like the battle that he fought is so much grander that it doesn't involve a sword, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I think well, we got a couple more chapters, you know, left in the book, and so that idea is kind of going to expand a little bit. I don't think he's anti-war at all, you know, like some pacifists, like, I don't know, think of Vietnam protesters and stuff, and maybe, I mean, they were, lots of cases they were right, okay, or, you know, they might have been right, it doesn't even matter what you think, but it's like, those people were probably just anti-war kind of period, whereas Frodo, mm-hmm. it's like, I don't know, like, obviously this whole cause was worth fighting for him, mm-hmm. but now he's done it. And he's never going to participate again. So I don't know. Right. Maybe it's more like he's retired or something. You know? But, right. Okay, so it's almost easy to kind of brush over at this point, but like the heavenly themes a little bit, like the role reversals with Gandalf being the squire now. You know, the most right. first shall be last shall be first, and the king
yeah,
of heaven.
It's like a
know?
Full reversal from the very start of the Fellowship of the Ring.
Right, right. So they sit down to dinner anyways, just to keep going on. Cool fairground, I imagine tent pavilions in place and stuff. And so at this one table is Frodo and Sam, Aragorn, Gandalf, King Éomer, Prince Imrahil, chiefs and captains, Legolas and Gimli. They do mention that standing silence again. Remember when they did that with Faramir when they were looking west to Numenor? It's the only thing that kind of functions as, or well, it functions as grace, and it's the only almost overt religious practice in Lord of the Rings that we talked about. It's kind of funny too, because when they did that with Faramir, they were in Ithilien, and they're doing right. it again, and they're in Ithilien, so kind of interesting. Right. To Sam's surprise, their servers are basically Pippin and Merry in full Gondor and full Rohan armor, right? And they're much, funny. Yeah, and they're much taller, right?
Right. They mistake them for like adolescent men.
Right? Yeah, yeah, and so. Sam's like super floored, surprised, and Pippa just says, hey, we're gonna have a ton of time after dinner to swap some stories. Get ready. And then you want to take that one quote there? At last, the glad day ended. It's just that. You can read it there.
At last, the glad day ended, and when the sun was gone and the round moon rode slowly above the midst of Anduin and flickered through the fluttering leaves, Frodo and Sam sat under the whispering trees amid the fragrance of fair Ithilien. And they talked deep into the night with Merry and Pippin and Gandalf. And after a while, Legolas and Gimli joined them.
All right. Okay. So they don't go into detail what they talked about, but Sam's overwhelmed by everything, right? I thought Tolkien, he listed out a couple of references, and I don't know, just if you want to say them, you can, but like they were just pretty quick and perfect, I thought. But
uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, there's like kind of joking about Merry and Pippin drinking the end drafts, and that explains why they're a lot taller. And yeah, I mean, once again, it's like comes off as a little comical here, but if you try to put yourself in the shoes of what Sam and Frodo have seen and been doing, they've been like laboring over brutal, depressing rock for what is it, months since the Fellowship?
It's been
broke?
A month. But that should be a lifetime.
A month that felt like a lifetime. Yeah. While their friends have been like fighting battles and encountering all these strange places none of them have ever been to. So and they didn't even know if they're Frodo and Sam didn't even know if they were all alive or what was going on. So
right. So
this is like a revelatory amount of stimuli.
Yes. So I don't know. It kind of I almost feel bad for Frodo and Sam, more so Sam, because he's the one that really loves all the sense of wonder and everything. Mm-hmm. Because it's just, I don't know, their journey, yeah, like you said, they were in this depressing landscape and everything, so it's just, they kind of got the shaft on that. You know, Sam's the one that loves stories, loves hearing everything, and then it's just like, let me actually just say what how Tolkien listed it. Orcs, talking trees, leagues of grass, galloping riders, glittering caves, white towers, golden halls, battles, tall ships sailing, all these passed through Sam's mind until he felt bewildered. And it's just, man, that kind of does suck. I missed out on all that. Mm-hmm. It's just a bummer to, I don't know, to, like, they got the shaft of which part of Middle-earth they got to see, I would say.
Yeah,
you know?
I also do, I feel like it reinforces the idea that they're, like, living through their own fairy tale, kind of. Like, Sam's hearing the fairy tale of what his friends were doing in reality while he was doing his side of the fairy tale, kind of. So I think it's maybe in real time reinforcing the fact for him that he's living through this grand story in a way that he can't completely conceptualize yet.
Yeah. The other thing, too, one of the books, I forget which one, but they commented Sam being so shocked by Merry and Pippin being, I think they said, 3 inches taller. Uh-huh. That should be a symbolic reference for how much they've matured just in the month that they've gone on, which is true. You know, I mean, Frodo and Sam have matured. Sam, most of all, I think, you know, the chief hero of the book here. Merry and Pippin have as well. So then Gandalf confirms it's the hands of the king or the hands of healing again, right? So it was, you know, Frodo and Sam, Aragorn had to go to the very brink of death ere he recalled you, putting forth all his power, right? So similar to that Faramir healing scene, if we remember that from the Houses of Healing, right?
Right, right.
And then Aragorn's the one that set him to sleep for a full fortnight. I guess, you know, so we kind of gave Aragorn the shaft this chapter. I think no worries, because I think he'll be the center of attention for the next one. I could be wrong, but I think he'll get enough playing time there. So
Okay.
So Gimli also confirms, this is a very loose end, but Gimli confirms Pippin was basically crushed by a troll in the battle. But he saw his foot kind of sticking out from it because Pippin did kill the troll. And that's how Gimli saved him, which is also pretty safe because that's a good way to pass through a battle, is just looking like your dad, you know? He was underneath a troll, so nobody would ever think to go kill him or stab him or something. They would just assume he's dead, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Merry came up with a bunch of supplies from Minas Tirith for, like, the celebration, I guess. I don't know. Nice. We'll find that out next chapter. It's not a big deal. All right. Anyways, they're all going to go to bed until the elf steals the show. This is the last little segment. We could easily brush over it, but I just found it way too cool that I think we got to talk about it. I don't care if this is a long episode. We got to talk about this. You want to take it? You're the more elven person of the two.
And I, said Legolas, shall walk in the woods of this fair land, which is rest enough. In days to come, if my elven lord allows, some of our folk shall remove hither. And when we come, it shall be blessed for a while. For a while, a month, a life, 100 years of men. But Anduin is near, and Anduin leads to the sea, to the sea, to the sea, to the sea. The white gulls are crying, the wind is blowing, and the white foam is flying. West, west away, the round sun is falling. Grey ship, do you hear them calling? The voices of my people that have gone before me. I will leave the woods that bore me, for our days are ending and our years failing. I will pass the wide waters, lonely sailing. Long are the waves on the last shore falling. Sweet are the voices in the lost isle calling. In Aresia, in elven home that no man can discover, where the leaves fall not, land of my people forever. And so, singing, Legolas went away down the hill.
All right. So, I will leave the woods that bore me. Our days are ending and our years are failing. All right. Mm-hmm. So as good, as heavenly, as Eastery as this chapter's been, they're still in a finite world, right?
Yes.
We were, you know, Two Towers and Return of the King, they were kind of, they were more so focused on men and mortals in the South. And so, like, the dominant themes were, in addition to Eucatastrophe, as we've been talking about for a lot of Return of the King, it was that, fairy tales come to life, you know, that astonishment from, like, I imagine Théoden, but then even, like, the people in Gondor had a lot, but Théoden the most, which I loved. But now, here, Legolas with this bit, I think this is really returning us back to Fellowship of the Ring, northern parts of the world where the elves are, this is the last hurrah, this is the, you know, right. The curtain call, They are going to fade the three elven rings. The one ring's destroyed now. So now they are, those are going to fade too. And the elves are going to, you know, they're going to mostly be leaving.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. This has been predicted since at least the Council of Elrond, probably before that. But yeah, I don't know. Thoughts?
Well, predicted well before the Council of Elrond.
Yeah.
Right?
Hasn't yeah.
it been?
Probably
isn't
Gildur.
It kind of the yeah. part of the theme of this entire age?
Yeah.
Is like that the elves are ending and the men are.
Yeah,
increasing in power. Yeah, I for me this is not to dismiss at all about like the joyous celebration of the earlier part of the chapter we were discussing, but I actually find like these references to the elves leaving Middle Earth like so much more emotionally moving.
Oh yeah, yeah, than, yeah.
Yeah, it's like it's. I can't say it's resonant because I don't know what to compare it to. Like this like sense of the people like. Disappearing out of the world in such a big way, but I think that's part of why it feels so unique. It's like this almost dreamlike sense, and these references to the elves leaving are like, it's maybe it's that you kind of feel the passage of time in a way that you don't, like when the story's happening, it's just like, oh yeah, like plot moving along, like events happen, but these the references to the elves leaving is like it contextualizes it in this grander like epoch or something like that. And you see the big picture of time changing and moving. And it's so, yeah, I find it like so intriguing and powerful.
Yeah. To add on to that, let me read this chunk of that Peter Kraft wrote basically about this scene. And maybe it'll fit with what you're saying too, or you tell me if it doesn't or where you see differences. But anyways, he says, in The Lord of the Rings, there are two opposite longings or deep desires. There is, of course, the desire to possess the ring, and that corresponds to the magic of power and technology. More subtly and sweetly, there is also another desire, a longing whose subject cannot be defined, much less possessed. This longing sweeps through the Lord of the Rings like a wind over the sea. In fact, the sea is one of its symbols, especially for Legolas in this scene, as it was for Tolkien and many island-dwelling Englishmen. Tolkien himself was haunted by a recurrent dream of the sea. He speaks of, and this is now from one of Tolkien's letters, my Atlantis hunting. This legend or myth or dim memory of some ancient history has always troubled me. In sleep, I had a dreadful dream of the inluctable wave, either coming out of the quiet sea or coming in towering over the green islands. It still occurs occasionally, though now exorcised by writing about it. This is where you got the idea for Numenor, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it always ends by surrender, and I awake gasping out of deep water. Kreef goes on to say, he says, any mystic or any surfer would understand that. And this guy himself, he's a dork, but he actually does surf. Of course, it is not literally the sea or the wave, but the thing they symbolize. And that is obviously God and heaven or paradise or union with God. It is no accident that when Lewis writes about an unfallen planetary Eden, it is an ocean planet of floating islands that must be ridden like waves. And if you want that, the Lewis book that he's talking about is Paralandra. Awesome book. Super cool. Okay. Oh, highly recommend it. But anyways, that is kind of true because when the elves think of the sea, well, they're thinking about a couple of things, but lots of them are thinking like, we're going to go across the sea to Valinor, which mm-hmm. is like the heaven on earth for the elves too.
Right, you know? Right. It's also, I feel like it's kind of, it does align with what it sounds like Tolkien's experience with the sea was. Like it was this idea or dream in his mind, but he wasn't like an ocean. He didn't like spend a lot of time like on the water
right.
or growing up on the water. Instead, it was like a concept that kind of permeated his memory or his dreams.
Well, he did spend a lot of time on the shore. Not a lot of time, but okay. a good amount of time. Like he had some very impactful trips to the coast.
Okay.
And he sketched waves, eerie nights and stuff, but then he was also in World War I, part of the chunk, he was on Coast Guard duty, so like throughout the
okay,
night, he was just watching the waves roll over and stuff. I've also offered this idea before, somewhere in the show, but like the music of the Ainur, remember our mm-hmm. special on that, it said that music itself was contained most in water, And, you know, I feel like elves are most in tune with that, to the sea.
So, yeah.
I don't know.
That's cool. Anyways, yeah, I feel like the way the elves talk about the ocean aligns with what I imagine Tolkien feeling about it.
Yeah.
Which is, like, powerful and beautiful, but also not totally familiar. Like, it's not the same as, like, if you somebody who, like, spends a ton of time on the water talks about the ocean.
Yeah.
Anyways, kind of interesting. It's just like it. I think that's part of what creates this dreamlike quality to it.
Yeah. Yeah. Last detail though, this is good enough that Legolas doesn't have to sleep. So, have elves not needed to sleep this entire time, or do they only have to not sleep when they're in beautiful places like Ithilien? Because if they haven't had to sleep, Legolas could have been their watch guard every night the Fellowship was traveling. Aragorn could have finally gotten some sleep. Like, he didn't sleep at that one night in Rohan. I remember specifically.
How about this? My thought is, like, what it sounds like the elves sleeping is, like, they walk through the woods.
Right.
But they still have to remove themselves from, like, normal consciousness. So it's, like, sleep by another form. So it's not like if he was on watch, he would still be tiring himself. It's like he would have to kind of be in a different state of consciousness to rest.
Yeah.
So it's almost like he has to be like active and in an active but dreamlike state.
Yeah.
To be resting instead of just like he can just absorb energy from being near nature.
Right. I kind of assumed he couldn't do this in Moria. Yeah. wouldn't work out as well. Just wandering around Moria. But yeah. All right, so they spend some days at this Cormallen place. It's actually very close to the Heneth Anun, which is that waterfall place where Frodo and Sam went with Faramir.
Right.
And I don't know, I thought it was kind of weird. Frodo and Sam were retracing their steps at places.
Mm-hmm.
I guess this was the nice part of their journey, but I don't know. I would mildly think I wouldn't want to be thinking about that at all, at least now. Right. You know, maybe I can look back on it later, but not right now. Anyway, Sam's sad to hear
I wonder, do you feel like, is there any, like, kind of resurrection significance to that they're like repeating something that they did before, like they've come in a circle in a way?
Yeah, I don't know. I thought it's more know. It's more like you revisit somewhere that was important to you, like soldiers to an old battlefield, like 20 years later, but I wouldn't go like a month after the battle or something. I don't know. Or like, you know, if you had like a race somewhere and you go revisit, I don't know, something that. But yeah, this is where Sam heard about all the, because this is where he saw the Oliphant, and then he had heard, we destroyed all of them at Minas Tirith. And it's just, man, that's a shame. I think he was actually sad for the Oliphants themselves, but then it's also like, man, yeah, he just can't be everywhere at once. Sucks. Mm-hmm. You know, we got the shaft, most depressing.
Yeah.
Heart of Middle Earth is what we got to see, but yeah. Anyways, everyone rests up and heals. It does sound like some people had to go into Mordor and destroy what was left of whatever the forces were.
Mm-hmm.
But they all pack up, and the chapter ends with them sailing down the Anduin. They stay at Osgiliath for one night, and then you want to take that last thing?
And there they remained for one day, and the day after they came to the green fields of the Pelennor and saw again the white towers under Tall Mindolowin, the city of men of Gondor, the last memory of Westerness that had passed through the darkness and fire to a new day. And there in the midst of the fields they set up their pavilions and awaited the morning, for it was the eve of May, and the king would enter his gates with the rising of the sun.
Okay, yeah, I look like I'm recording. All right, All right, Clifford. We are back again. Happy Easter. He is risen. Theoretically, I've gotten to this point that everything's finally edited. And I've done it.
Happy theoretical Easter to you as well, Patrick. Great work on accomplishing this hypothetical task.
Yeah. All right, so for full disclosure, when we were recording the Mount Doom chapter and then this one after it, the big U-catastrophe, Field of Cormallen one, we were doing that right at the beginning of Lent, and then, you know, and I remember that because then I was walking around and I was like, oh, you know, that'd be kind of cool if it was like on Easter. And then I looked at the calendar and it's like, Easter's so late this year. I have exactly enough weeks
to be able to do this.
But that means I have to spend all Lent editing these stupid episodes. And they're so big because there's so much to talk about and I have no editing abilities. So anyways, we try to put it out because
you're pretty darn close.
Yeah, well, hopefully I get it done. This is in the Tuesday. So I don't know. We'll see. Hopefully I get it out. I bet I will, because how could I pass up the Good Friday, Easter Sunday double? That was two big days to spend with this podcast or listen in days in the future, which will be 99% of people. Anyways, how you doing, Clifford?
I'm doing well.
Yeah.
Maybe not as busy as you, but heck, time of the year. Working on big plans, big decisions.
Nice.
Exciting things to come.
Yeah.
So.
Cool. Well, yeah, it's busy time for me. I don't know, this podcast, glad to have these out. Glad it's Easter. It's been a long Lent. Oh my gosh. Anyways, everything else is pretty good for me though. No real complaints, only superficial complaints.
It's a good way to put it.
So anyways, just a heads up for everybody. This has been a pain in my butt for the past 40 days. So the next episode, I think Aragorn's crowning is in May. It's May crowning kind of thing. So I don't know. That's not that far off anymore. So there's a chance I just don't put out the next one until like May 1st-ish. We'll see. So I need a bit of a break. Like I had zero break from book 5, Leaf by Niggle thing, and then straight into book 2. Because I, you know, it looks like I took a break if you look at the things, but it's like, no, that was the weekend I was in DC doing all the stuff, and there was no time.
Mm.
Yeah. All right. Anyways, though, yeah, no real complaints. Life's good. We're really falling down the hill. The most massive episodes are done, but the book is not done. Still 100 pages to go. So hopefully you guys have all enjoyed this so far. Thank you for listening. And yeah, that'll about do it for me.
All right. Thanks, y'all.
So, at this point, what's left of the Mordor forces start aimlessly wandering.
Quick introduction. This is chapter 4, book 6.
No. They know what this is. Okay. No, we're not doing an introduction. No, okay. We're just jumping forget into that. It. This will make it move forget faster. That. Absolutely.
The action
forget
has
that.
Begun.
Yeah, all right. We're not done. This isn't even the end of the intro yet. Gosh, I'm going to have to cut all this out. Actually, this is going to be a blooper at the end of this. That's what this is going to be.